What were some of the parts of the March with the Black Bloc that stood out in your mind, and what happened?
Okay. Well, let's see. There were several good portions of the block. First of all, the overall impression, and that's what really went with you when you were in the Black Block all day. You know, even more than any specific instance, that all day we were roaming the streets. You know, we were organized together with comrades. Some you knew, some you didn't, but you know, you had a common sense of purpose. You know, we had some beautiful banners, and we were just this mob that everywhere we went, you know, we were in control of the situation. We were really empowered to be able to walk through the streets without being harassed. And everywhere we went, people were really positive, and they responded to us really well. We were usually through the day, we were beginning to get communications reports in from people in tactical with the April 16th mobilization. Particularly one WAF from San Francisco, who was doing a really good job of that and telling us, you know, well, this is where they think we need you. You know, oh, there's some cops massing over here. We'd really like the Black Bloc to go over that direction. And the Bloc usually followed most of those requests when given, because usually they really did need our support there. Sometimes, you know, us just showing up caused the cops to back down where they were planning to do, like, mass arrests. They wouldn't, because suddenly what was an intersection held by maybe 100 people, you know, could swell to, like, 1,000. Because not only did you have the Bloc, you know, organized progressive anarchists, but lots of people tagged along that really swelled our numbers. They might not be in the lead, but they tagged along behind us to see what was going on. You know, I could probably say, you know, we probably had 5% of our contingent was related media at any time. They seemed to swarm us all the time. Sometimes when we went to a location where they requested support, it didn't always, you know, de-escalate things. A lot of times it escalated things. Maybe the cops weren't as strong there as they thought. And when a bunch of anarchists show up, we'd come up to the barricades. And then it'd be a question of, well, can we push down this barricade? Can we move this barricade? Can we take this barricade and put it some way to cause the police and the delegates more trouble than the demonstrators? Other times, you know, what we could do at the barricades was pretty limited, because we had this line of people who were, you know, quite frankly, really strong in civil disobedience, and you just could not move them out of the way. And you couldn't get up to confront the cops or move a barricade because you had your blockaders there, and you were worried about hurting them or whatever. Generally, let's see, there was a couple sessions that were probably the most successful route of the police was over at George Washington University. I think maybe it was on 20th and I don't remember the exact location, but it's one where there was like a lot of confrontation between the police and the demonstrators, and the demonstrators were largely sitting in the intersection because the police were being pretty menacing, and the Black Bloc came around the corner and started facing down the police, right? And the cops ended up charging us like 3 times, you know, occasionally, you know, hitting people and things like that. They ended up charging us 3 times, and during like part of it, you know, I think the tank was around the corner, and a lot of the demonstrators were very concerned, like that, you know, we were provoking the cops to attack us, and we were provoking the cops, you know, whatever. But there was a real big division there between the people who were wanting to stand up to the cops, you know, and hold the line, and people wanted to sit down to calm them down. A lot of those cops on that line, in particular. Usually through most of the day, the cops were pretty cool, and they didn't charge people or beat up a lot. I mean, some of it happened, but usually it was like, it didn't seem so organized and systematic as it has been in other places. But that line had a lot of hotheads on it, and there were a lot of us. There were a lot of us, and they were getting spooked, and the way they were trying to deal with the spook was, you know, to charge out, lash out with clubs. They weren't trying to arrest anyone at that point. Eventually, There was one problem where one of the pacifist demonstrators was so concerned about everyone's safety that he said, and I'll paraphrase, you know, if you don't sit down, if you don't calm down, and those cops come across and, you know, hurt my friend, I'm going to kill you. That was pretty surreal. When the cops were charging, everybody was, you know, chanting nonviolence. Mostly the Black Bloc, you know, stood around. Some of us, like, sat down and tried to calm down or backed away. Usually when the cops strike, you know, we got out of the way, but luckily nobody, like, ran and panicked. So they all handled it pretty cool. 3 or 4 people got clubbed pretty bad. But while this was going on, usually maybe one of the problems with the Black Bloc was that sometimes it got a little strung out. and like the banners, because they were heavier or whatever, more difficult to maneuver, they would fall way behind. So eventually the tail would catch up with the banners, and behind them would be all the stragglers who were supporting and watching and, you know, following to see where the action was. So usually you ended up with something of a vanguard of the Black Blockers, who were quick to the scene because they know, oh, they need our support right now. And then more of them would come in as a pretty steady stream. So as the cops would begin to get more and more, you know, upset and wanting to do more and more actions, there'd be more and more Black Blockers there. So in this case, what happened was they moved up, and I guess they didn't get the reinforcements that they expected, or as many as they wanted. So they basically left that intersection and pulled back about a block, trotting back. All right, when they took off, you know, give us an inch, we'll take a mile. We ended up pushing them probably three blocks back into George Washington University, where the frats and stuff were, into the campus. I don't know how, like, strategic that was. But us pushing them back all the way, some of the people in the back part of the block grabbed all the large university dumpsters that were around and pulled them out into the street. I mean, we had, like, three or four dumpsters out into the street. People in, like, the community that were around us, you know, were yelling stuff. They were excited, and they all came out to watch, see what was going on. And, you know, later, when we came back for our victory march through that neighborhood, they all opened up their houses and started blaring their stereos, and we had a good old party. But at the time, they were watching what was going on. You know, they weren't screaming at us, get out of our neighborhood, stop fighting the cops or anything. Once we got the dumpsters set up, and we pushed the cops back, then the Black Bloc pulled back and went back to the next place where they needed to go along. That was really well handled. Now those dumpsters are in the way, and those demonstrators that were so concerned about, you know, non-violence, non-confrontational cops, so that you could confront the cops, you know, non-violently, just because you're willing to stand up for yourself, you know, and say, here we are, you're not going to move us, that you can actually gain ground. And I think pushing those cops back, you know, helped not only, like, hold that intersection for a while, but also helps show people, you know, other ways to be nonviolent yet confrontational. We don't have to be non-confrontational with the police. This is a confrontational demonstration. We were wanting to confront the World Bank and the IMF. We wanted to stop it. Probably another thing that was pretty interesting was afterwards, after we'd gone running around and doing blockades for a while, I think there was the rumor that the IMF and World Bank were, you know, ended early because they started early, and that or that, you know, they wanted the blockaders that had simply been blockading so long, and since most delegates had gotten in, there wasn't much point in it. So there was discussion of, like, well, what are we going to do now? And a large part of the bloc felt that, hey, you know, all we can, if they're already having the meeting, we have to go in there and occupy it. We have to get through the barricades, and we have to get in there and get to the bank itself. And the other half were like, well, you know, we want to be able to do the blockades again tomorrow. And the blockaders, if they unlock and move the blockades, they all have those lines of cops. So they were really worried about having them arrested after pretty much the action was over, or having all of their equipment for lockdown seized and taken from them. So it got worked out between the Black Bloc. We'd taken a break at Farragut Park out there, and we'd come into a line of cops. And instead of confronting them, it broke down to, like, a drum circle, and then everybody went out to the park to take a break, because we'd been running around since, like, 6 a.m., you know, marching. Most of the blockaders, they went someplace, they stayed put. We were constantly on the move. Back from GWU, we had gained a dumpster and taken it with us and pushed it everywhere we went, like a little tank. People got up and rode it and waved the flag, and that was pretty cool. Pushing that dumpster around, we brought it up to Farragut Park, and we were deciding what to do, figuring out what to do. And then we had, you know, a big meeting. I wouldn't really necessarily call it consensus. Basically, it was everybody who gathered in the park to take a break, and together with some people who had the communications gear to let us know what the mobilization was planning. So lots of people wanted to go out and take the bank now. Other people wanted to support the lockdown. And there's a question of, like, the order in which the decisions should take place. But the barricaders, they wanted out. And we all agreed, as someone said, yeah, we need to save the hippies. So what happened was there was some division over that. But eventually all came to a rough consensus that it was important to get the blockaders out. So when we got the blockaders out, They were trying to decide whether we wanted to decide what our next course of action was, since we were all gathered there, or decided after we got all the blockaders out. What ended up happening is once we pretty much got a decision that we were going to get the blockaders out, we ended up going with it and didn't make our decision later that after we got all the blockaders through at this street, we'd march on the bank. We didn't come to any kind of decision like that at all. I think that was probably, we probably should have when we were all assembled, because after we were leading the victory parade and getting the blockaders out, it really confused the Black Bloc because we just had masses and masses of numbers, you know? And as we built and built and built, we grew and we got involved with the other people marching towards the Ellipse. So that really broke up what made the Bloc successful was, like, when you saw all the Bloc together, they could move and act pretty much as one. You know, affinity groups were off doing their own thing and operating autonomously, but pretty much as a Bloc, we went one place and followed our banners. But as our banners got split up and the Black Bloc got split up into simply the throng of people that we were building around us, which I think was positive, too, since we were really getting out there and exposing, and everybody was really supportive of us and had followed us around all day and cheered when we'd come along the Bloc. That we weren't in any kind of position then to make a decision as what we were going to do as the Bloc. I think the Bloc could have used a lot more communications gear inside of it. I think we could have used our banners much more effectively to marshal us. But pretty much by that part of the day, we're talking about 3 or 4 p.m., and as we got sucked into the street party that was happening in GWU, and basically the Ellipse legal demonstration spilling out into all the illegal direct action areas, which is probably something else they didn't talk about, because that's where all the fun was going out. I mean, by the time that late in the afternoon, people were in Constitution Avenue blocking it. They were just all over the place. One of the things I noticed as the victory march came along, you know, we had a lot of Black Blockers coming through that along by the Ellipse. We came into a line and line, all these cops. It must have been 50 cops with, like, motorcycles and line after line of them. And this line of marshals, I think with Job with Justice and little orange vests, you know, directing people and pointing them where to go. Like, we don't know where to go, you know. We're not going to run a line of 50 cops, particularly when they're not... It was, what were they protecting? You could have gone around them because they were in the park. So the marshals there, if they were trying to be peacekeepers, were really unnecessary. And after this day where we managed to do this demonstrations, move from block to block on march constantly, just all day long, you know, well-coordinated, taking care of everybody. Even though, you know, Black Blockers probably got, when violence came down, they got most of it. It was pretty nonviolent. We didn't get beat up that much by the cops. They could have taken a lot more opportunities to crack heads. When they did pepper gas or any kind of spray or smoke bombs, everybody was really prepared for that. Everybody had their gear together, and those that weren't, you know, knew to get back. So I think we handled that really, really well. At the last lockdown, I think I probably should bring up, I saw some... one thing that I thought was pretty funny in retrospect at the time, you know, he's like, oh, well, what's going to happen with some of the worst prop PD? There was a media a car, some folks in the media, and the media had followed the anarchists around all day. And like when we were having our meetings, some anarchists really didn't like the media taping the meetings. So, you know, they said, hey, don't tape us now. You know, we're trying to come to a decision. So people would put up the flags, they'd get in their way, and the media could be downright obnoxious, you know. It's anarchists now have their own paparazzi. So a lot of people, and particularly since the media we know is just going to distort whatever we have to say, I really doubt that any of the media, even though we gave them all copies of our statement, the Revolutionary Capitalist Bloc will ever print it. Besides certain portions that they can construe to say we advocated that the Black Bloc engage in violence, we just didn't, you know, we didn't discourage it either, you know, but they wanted to try and bring that out based on their coverage so far. A lot of people were really upset at the media, and, you know, they parked their car down at one of the hottest places of the demonstration, and some people started, you know, jumping up on the bumper, and it wasn't too long before they were jumping in the windows. Like I say, this was like the last of the three lockdowns we unlocked for the victory march. So we had gained everybody at both those lockdowns, and then other people joining us up on the victory parade at that point. So it was wall-to-wall people here, and the cops could not see what was going on at all. Some of the media were there, of course, but I don't know if they actually taped or bothered to film any of it because it was their car. they bothered to put a ticket on it, and then they put a big piece of poster board on it that I thought was really funny, and then later popped up on the Indie Media Org website, which was media, cover the issues, not this car. And I think that was pretty great. That was pretty great. After that, you know, it was just a successful route. I think the big question was for us all, particularly toward the end of the day, that if we're doing the blockades, if we're doing the barricades, in a city like D.C., it's really hard to do. It's really spread out, and quite frankly, I'm impressed with how much of the city we could hold. But to stop one or two people at a time, or even a van load of folks getting to a meeting, really, really hard to do, because they were moving in through restaurants and tunnels and all kinds of stuff, and apparently they started getting them in really, really early, even before some of the blockades were set up, that if a blockade, you know, doesn't work, if a blockade doesn't work, you can't stop people from coming in and out, then all we're doing with the blockades for the civil disobedience is not letting our group of protesters, marchers, have full mobility to, like, press police lines and actually get to the location the meeting's happening. If maybe we hadn't had so many barricades last so long, particularly when they weren't being useful, to broken those up and instead decided to march on the bank, I think we could have had enough people that no matter how many cops they had, we would have been able to get inside and disrupt the meeting itself. And I do think that in the future, unless we have special considerations with terrain, those tactics will work some of the time, but not all the time. And we really have to start considering looking at more and more occupations to shut down these meetings. That will mean a lot more confrontation with the police. That'll be a lot more than simply, you know, getting to an undefended intersection by the cops and locking down. We'll actually have to go, we'll have to press, we'll have to gain ground, you know, and do it, you know, in a nonviolent fashion, because if we get violent, the cops will just, you know, really break bad on us. But I mean, it's going to come to questions like, well, you know, we come into the door of the World Bank, do we break down the door or not? Does that count as poverty destruction, or is that in the way of us disrupting this meeting? And for symbolic, for spectacle, I mean, it was great spectacle. The way the national media, the corporate media tended to cover it, they could have done a much better job covering the numbers. They always, always underwrote the numbers by amounts we just thought were grotesque. It's getting about 20,000 were the numbers that we're looking at, and the media was reporting it sometimes as few as 7,000, which is curious because, you know, by the day they're saying, oh, well, there's much less demonstrators, but they're still doing hit-and-run tactics in the hundreds. So, you know, we had 600 people arrested the night before, and plus all the ellipse, we probably easily had 20,000 people. The Black Bloc alone was probably 1,000 on the move, and that's just the people who are actively part of the Bloc, not all the anarchists who were locked down, not the anarchists at the Independent Media Center, not the anarchists doing support work, you know, autonomously, or feeding people with food, not bombs. And we were here, and we were in force. And, you know, we definitely were, you know, an ideology that was very present, and people were very aware. A lot of people did a very good job not mobilizing us. The myth that peacekeepers and union members would somehow descend on us to stop us from engaging in property destruction or something, it did not materialize. There was no sort of conflict there, except for that one intersection where one older guy got, you know, threatened to kill someone to maintain pacifism. It pretty was laid back. That's pretty much all I have to say on it. I'm trying to think of something.
Were you on the IWW part of the blockade?
No. I actually did not get involved with the IWW part of the blockade, which is something else, which is a whole other section of anarchists, and the Anarchist Soccer League were on a whole separate portion of the blockade route. We largely stuck around the north and the east and moved around where there seemed to be a lot of trouble. Though I hear they could have used a lot more support in the south, and maybe if we'd gotten a little bit more tactical. But some cases, it's just a case of firefighting. Maybe it would have been practical to have split the block. But I think we would have had to decide to do that at the very beginning, because once we were going, it took a lot of hurting, a lot of control, a lot of people paying attention and you know, marshaling as such anarchists can do, to just maintain the block as it was without it disintegrating into people going off and doing their own actions. While we also understood that as a block, you know, that's where we had a lot of collective power. It's when as a block that we went up and confront the police that they were like, oh, well, you know, we don't know about this now. Maybe we need to give these protesters some space. When anarchists were off by themselves, you know, protesters of just four or five, there are cases of Secret Services coming up and stealing their gas masks and their equipment and signs, harassing them, arresting them. So, you know, being black blockers all masked up and then off by yourself tended to bring down a little bit more police repression than we could get together when we were collective. At the same time, the affinity group model seemed to work pretty well. We had affinity groups usually around 5 to 10 people. You know, 5 people would go grab a dumpsters, 5 people would go run over and start raiding a construction site, and then everybody would go to the construction site and start erecting barricades. And it also let us get together and reassemble pretty quick. But also, sometimes you gotta, we moved without having a meeting or anything about it. Like, say the back of the block would decide to pull out. Like, I think there was one case where the black block probably did back down from the cops. There wasn't seem to be a whole lot gained from it. It didn't look like that important of a place. And all it was doing was getting pretty hot. So in one case, we did pull out. The back of the block pulled out and went off to the next location. Maybe just a question of us not getting told what was going on. And then the others held the line for a while because we could hold a line of cops at bay while the rest of the block would take off. And the cops, they don't know what to do yet. Are we going to come back? The media, do they chase the rest of the block? Do they follow us? Where does the chopper go? There usually had a few that stayed behind at the last action while the majority of the block moved on, and then a front group got there ahead.
Well, it seemed like maybe from studying some of the needs, from Seattle, that different affinity groups had taken upon themselves. Like, there were people who were prepared to deal with, tear gas problems,
right,
and defend the group against that, and other sorts of jobs like that. Mm-hmm. People that were prepared to rearrange furniture and so on.
Yeah, one nice thing about the Black Bloc itself, it was kind of like a mobilization within a mobilization. We had everything we needed to be, you know, autonomous forever. We had our own media there. We had our own, you know, drums. We had our own medical support. I know a lot of anarchists just spent all of their time doing medical. One of my housemates treated an anarchist for a broken nose that they got. It's probably interesting that more anarchists got beat up than got arrested. So I don't know how that figures. Some people would probably rather be beat up than arrested. And overall, I think only 25 people were arrested that day. Had they conducted mass arrests, I think it would have been a lot easier for the police to clean the streets. We were a mini mobilization. We had everything we needed. Small block could, you know, grab and do barricade destruction or barricade improvement, depending on where those barricades were. When, you know, cops set up barricades, we could move those barricades and put them where we wanted them. That was great. I think there was one confrontation, someone else will tell you about it, where the anarchists had picked up, you know, the police barricades and were moving them down the street, and the cops charged them with motorcycles. It was impressive, you know, that we could elicit that response and even hold that as long as we did, I mean, against bikes. But I think that showed people that, you know, we don't have to be in these protest corrals. Just because there's a fence there doesn't mean it's right. And I think we'll be seeing a lot more of that in demonstrations to come. Like I said, I think the medical people were amazing. We probably could have used more people communicating between the affinity groups and between the mobilization at large. I think we needed more communications gear.
Okay, what about the women participating in the Black Bloc?
The women in the Black Bloc, well, they're just like the men. I would have to say, as far as you're looking at a protest, it'd be great to try and say that, oh, yes, anarchist Black Bloc is all just a bunch of white teenage punk rockers, which is by no means the case at all. You know, they can't see, apparently, the skin colors being our mass. We probably had a good as racial mix as any other group there, and we had a really good gender balance, I thought. Women, they were on the front lines, they were doing medical, there really wasn't much difference in what they did from any male members of the block, you know, and everybody's masked up. It's kind of hard to tell sometimes what sex anyone is anyway. I know that some of the women were some of the most adamant ones pushing us to do, you know, get up, get off of our butts, stop waiting around here, and get a move on. I think maybe they had a little bit more endurance than the rest of us, and a lot of them were, quite frankly, you know, let's go march on the bank. Let's march on the bank. That's what we're here for. I wouldn't say that there was really any difference between them and the male members of the Black Bloc, and it's kind of a silly question because we don't have so many hang-ups like that in anarchism as other movements might have. One of the things about the Black Bloc is, even though that if you know people, you know, you probably can tell who they are beneath the mask. But still, when you get that many anarchists together, no one knows everyone. And it really helps us not have leaders. You know, when someone's with a mask is up there saying, we should do this, we should do that, well, people have to evaluate, is that the right decision to make? You know, if people had banner, nah, that wasn't enough for them to be making the right decision, you know. And people largely made the decision together through their own actions. That was usually, you made decision through action. You decided what streets to go to because you said, oh, it sounds like there are people, need people over there. And somebody like would start shouting, you know, Black Bloc, Black Bloc, let's go to I and 16. Black Bloc, Black Bloc, let's go to 20th and 1st. Black Bloc, Black Bloc, slow down, we're losing the rest of us. But everybody was yelling that, you know. So it was usually if like a core of people got together and started trying to direct the Black Bloc together as a group, you know? Or maybe it was a couple members of an affinity groups would get together and people knew and trusted. But I think the anonymity, you know, really stops us from having leaders in ways. Because if it was just one or two of us, it could fall in that they would be the ones directed to be having the authoritative decision. And I think part of that is if they could have identified who the leaders of the Black Bloc were, they probably would have snatched them up. And we just didn't. We just didn't. I know, they didn't listen to me a lot.
Anything else you want to say? Hey, what's your name?
Yeah, I'm Flint. I'm with the Workers' Solidarity Alliance and the IWW. So, and I do also some stuff with Free Radio. I was largely running around with a tape recorder and getting lots of street sounds. All I'd have to add is probably that day alone, the anarchists had the streets. There was no question about it, you know. Not only did we have complete control of the streets, but it was only the locations where the police had read the direct barricades, you know, that they could hold those lines. And even those, we test and prodded and pushed. You know, had we been a few more, had we had a bit more support, we could have gone anywhere we wanted to. And that was so very empowering. To be in there in solidarity with our comrades and to know that, you know, together, even though we all, you know, are free to do our own thing and all have our own agendas and everything like that, that we are united among some common goals and some common needs, and that in collective struggle, then, you know, we can do pretty much anything. We can face down a line of riot cops, you know, dogs and bikes and helicopters, and gain ground. You know, that's pretty inspiring. That's pretty inspiring the same way, like, that as we roamed around, you know, we could see anarchist graffiti going up everywhere. I never saw anyone do it. I never saw anyone do any graffiti. And yet, there it was, constantly. And the later on in the day it got, the more I saw. And, you know, hey, that's property destruction that I think D.C. deserves, because they won't let us put up flyers. If you let us put up flyers, we wouldn't have to use paint. But if we're going to take the chance of getting arrested for putting a flyer, well, I think we better make it last. So it was just really inspiring. I think it's probably the best. I wasn't in Seattle, so, you know, I probably missed out on that. But I'd say as far as a Black Bloc march went, I've been in several. That was by far the most inspiring one I've been in.
Were you there when the cars were moved to make blockades?
I was not there when the cars were moved to move blockades. Mostly they were moving blockades, construction materials, and dumpsters while I was there.
Okay. Anything else you want to add, Flint?
No, that's about it. I think probably one thing we did show our fellow activists at the demonstration was that, you know, there are a variety of tactics, all of them nonviolent, which can be used in a demonstration, besides just sitting there passively singing "We Will Overcome," waiting for our designated cue to be arrested, you know, symbolically and put on a bus. I mean, a lot of that's going on right now. It's the April 17th Monday afternoon. The meeting's already going on, and apparently the demonstrators are negotiated with the police for a pretty much systematic arrest. Most of the day, we spent our time making sure people didn't get arrested, so that the blockades could hold if you're going to have them. I do think CD has its place. However, I do think probably the passive tactics of at least the last 20 years of people just getting arrested as some sort of symbolic feature, when the corps are openly hostile to discussing any of the issues, when the media doesn't care whether it was 5 people or 500 who were arrested, it doesn't really make that much a difference in how much they examine the issues, that civil disobedience, or at least, you know, committing the illegal act that temporarily gets you timed out is while a good tactic, very limiting. And we can take back the streets, we can occupy, we can push through. And, you know, we don't have to get all of our heads busted in. The police will not always attack you. In many cases, they will back down. And you can go pretty much anywhere you want if you have enough people behind you and enough of their resolve is there to do it.
Yeah, and I almost got to forget, sometimes it's being here all the time. I work in D.C., so being here all the time, you know, you're pretty much inundated with wow, this is America, these all the monuments, this is the center of, you know, the power of the U.S. military-industrial complex, and all day it was anarchists running amok through the streets of D.C., you know? Of course, D.C. doesn't really have a democracy in it or anything, but here we were, out in the streets, in force, you know, going by the Washington Monument, you know, barricaded outside of the White House, running up and down through the heart of, like, the nation's capital, in the heart of big government, and completely being able to do whatever we wanted. Whatever we wanted. There were no number of government representatives that could stop us from taking the streets, moving stuff around, and it was just really inspiring. Here we are in the Capitol, anarchists, you know, completely outside the law, constantly at an illegal demonstration, and, you know, doing it all together. I'm going to be thinking every time I walk through D.C., I will look at it in a completely different way. I'll no longer think of it as my friend Lynn Blacken likes to say, that the city of death, where, you know, all hope has been crushed and everything is filtered through a corporate media, but rather it's a city that can come back to life whenever it chooses.
Speaking of that, what have, you know, local residents that you've bumped into had to say to you about these demonstrations? What are they thinking?
Well, you know, probably it's local residents have been pretty popular. We didn't really, that part of D.C. is pretty much institutional, where the government, in one form or another, owns most of the buildings. Many of the restaurants and things were closed. But it was when we got over to the campus side, where there was residential living, that we encountered a lot more people in their homes and stuff. And sometimes, you know, they're like, yeah, hippies, go home, and stuff like that. But other people were really, really supportive. Some of the people from their homes came down and joined us in the streets. Other people turned up their radios and stereos and, you know, kind of turned GWU into a big old street party. A lot of people were supportive. About the only people I heard were negative were some people at a hotel that were standing outside watching it going on. I guess they couldn't have had anything that important to do. But, you know, complaining that, you know, well, you know, why don't you people, you don't have to take over all the streets. And taking over the streets is illegal. You shouldn't be doing that. And, you know, a lot of people come at it with different things. Overall, most of the people I encountered in the streets were really, really helpful for us. But that part of D.C. doesn't have too many residents in it.
What about in other neighborhoods that you've been in, Other neighborhoods?
I'm in, I come through, in fact, came up to here in Mount Pleasant, which is where a lot of us activists are based, since we have a pretty strong roots with Mount Pleasant Radio and a lot of other things going on and work with the Latino community. They've been really supportive. They ask me, how's it going on? You've been doing a good job, you know? How are the demonstrations going? Real friendly. They want to know what's going on. I mean, you know, we have a lot of more functions, or more like social parties. We're giving out food, things like that. Overall, I haven't, you know, worried that I'm going to be harassed or that people, you know, are really opposed to our presence here at all. They seem to be generally supportive. You know, I mean, it'd be great to see more people in the streets. It'd be great to see more people in the streets. But you know, we're getting there. We're getting there. And you know, maybe if it'd been a demonstration in people's neighborhoods, you know, we would have seen something different. But the problem is that that is down there in the middle of D.C. One thing that's probably by the end of Sunday, was that D.C. is a big tourist town. And probably by the late afternoon, after we were sure the meetings were mostly over, and we had the victory march with all the puppets and things, we were getting down to the Ellipse, we all just kind of dispersed into the normal D.C. traffic that was there, which was largely tourists. I mean, a lot of tourists came by, talked to us, found out what was going on, found out about our signs. One of our friends got, like, heat stroke,
And we ended up having to go over to one of the big museums, national museums, and sitting down. And he said, "Well, you can't sit here. It's a fire hazard. Well, why don't you come in the building and get some of this air conditioning, you know, at a museum?" And that was real nice. We had a lot of, we got some nice dialogue with people who were there just to do tourism in the nation's capital. Yeah, tourism in the nation's capital, anarchists running amok. I mean, the tour buses, you know, would come by very close to where, you know, blockades or large marches were going by, and I thought that was great too. I mean, look, that's what democracy looks like. On your left, you see a group of Black Bloc anarchists. I think one discussion we had with one guy who must have been a Marine, he still had the buzz cut and everything, and this was over by GWU's side during the victory march, and some anarchists had an inverted, you know, American flag, which obviously means, you know, the country's in crisis, all that sort of thing, which we would tend to regard anything involving the flag would be the country being in crisis. It's not like we set it on fire or anything. They marched with it all day. So he apparently, you know, thought that was somewhat disrespectful, but then we began a discussion of the flag and freedom and things like that. And then he's like, "Oh, and you know, you need to use this concoction to block out that gas." And then he wished us luck and sent us on our way. So I'm like, wow, that's pretty cool.
Thank you.